Our guest tonight is Professor of Politics and International Relations Suzanne Zwingle of Florida International University in Miami, Florida. Professor Zwingle has written about international feminist strategies as applied to human rights treaties like CEDAW. Co-wrote a book with her two colleagues called Feminist Strategies in International Governance, which offers an introduction to contemporary struggles for women's rights and to overcome gender oppression within intergovernmental and non-governmental organizations. We've asked Professor Zwingle to talk about the importance of a feminist perspective in creating and enforcing international treaties as a frame for our October treaty actions, and the realities challenging patriarchy and planning for international peace and security. There will be a time for question and answers following this presentation, so maybe jot down questions as the professor is speaking. Welcome, Professor Zwingle. Can you speak about what a feminist perspective might look like within treaties, and the challenges to moving these agreements to a more collaborative, less winner-take-all model?
Okay, good evening. Can you let me know if you can hear me okay?
You sound great.
Okay, super. Well, first and foremost, I would like to thank you very much for inviting me to share my work with you. I'm a big fan of WILP. I teach your work often to my students, and you know, the fact that you have been active for over 100 years in such a sustained way, I think that is one of the best feminist strategies that you can actually find out there. So you know a lot about this already, obviously, but let me share my thoughts. So your focus is on international treaties this month of October and feminist strategies around them. I first wanted to introduce maybe a few distinctions between different kinds of treaties that we can see. Partly I say this because of where I come from, because the treaty that I have studied the most is actually the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So that's a human rights treaty, and that is a different kind of treaty than the ones that you showcased this month, like the Iran nuclear deal or the Vienna Convention and all those treaties, because those treaties really deal about state interaction. So it's agreements between states, and as you rightly point out in your accompanying material, those kind of treaties, I think, are a different way of settling disputes. You know, you want to find common ground and make compromises without going to war. But this is something that takes place between states. The CEDAW Convention and other human rights conventions, they are also international treaties, but they function a little differently. Here, the states agree to a certain standard that they want to work towards domestically, so within their own states, right? So on one level, you could say these are maybe more demanding treaties, because it's really about working towards social transformation. However, on the other hand, because this is domestic work, it's less, controversial in the sense that if a state doesn't comply, if a state doesn't really take up its treaty responsibilities, this is not really putting any pressure on other states, right? So every state can either work towards their own improvement or not, and if not, the other states are not particularly threatened by that, and they will also not confront other states with it. So in that sense, it's a little less tension-ridden, these kind of human rights treaties, because they are not taking place between states. But what I think is really important about the human rights treaties is that they actually work towards a vision of peace, if you want, or we could also say it towards a vision of social justice. And For the perspective of CEDAW, it's very much a perspective of gendered justice, for gendered social transformation. So, you know, maybe you have also heard about Nancy Fraser's concept of gendered justice. I think all those terms are in a way what is underlying a treaty like CEDAW. So it's really thinking about, from a female perspective, how the world should be, how it is not right now, and how we could get towards this better place. And in the context of treaties, the role of the state is there is always very important, because in the context of international law, the treaties are something that states are responsible for. So it's mostly states. It's not, for example, multinational corporations and so forth, and also not directly individuals. So the states have this important responsibility there. And I think in that sense, these human rights treaties are an important learning ground for states. I mean, we do know that some of the states are not really taking it all that seriously, but other states do. And oftentimes they do because they are pressured to do so by civil society organizations. So there is, in a way, there's an important process, a potential at least, going on there. So I guess distinction there for me would be that this is a breeding ground for a vision of justice, of gendered justice, right? And I could go into more detail into the parameters of CEDAW, but maybe you are familiar with it, but maybe also this leads a little bit too far away from the topic of the call. But I think, so what's important about this also is it's work towards a positive vision of peace, right? You have this distinction between negative and positive peace in international relations. Negative peace is focusing on preventing military conflict to break out and take place. So that's more about imminent threats, so to say. And the idea of positive peace is much more about creating societal relationships and conditions that that will not make people suffer so much or have so many grievances that they actually consider warfare a good idea. So it's in a way a more sustainable, a more grounded kind of idea of peace, the idea of positive peace, and I think the two hang very much together. Now, when I think about these ideas that I take out of the human rights treaties, and CEDAW in particular, and look at the treaties that you showcase, for example, the Iran nuclear deal and others, I think it's very useful to have this more grounded societal vision that is very strong in the human rights treaties in order to critically examine those interstate treaties, like the Iran nuclear deal, for example. Because on first sight, I guess if you look at interstate treaties, this doesn't seem to affect societies all that much. It seems to be an affair that's between governments, right? And one government can agree with another, work out a deal, or as it is currently the case, of course, with the withdrawal of the United States, it can also pressure other governments in trying to force them to change their behavior, right? And so I think from a feminist perspective, when we look at that, two issues come to mind. One is maybe a little more superficial. I mean, you can look at what is actually going on in terms of, let's say, gender constructions on the level of how do governments deal with each other. And again, with a view to the Iran nuclear deal, it seems to me we are looking at a situation of competitive masculinity there, where you know, the United States posture is really about bringing Iran to its knees. But of course, this doesn't happen if you withdraw from a treaty and impose sanctions, because you know there's some reputation to uphold on the other side, and not to back down in view of this kind of you know, posture of domination. So that's sort of an interesting gender perspective, I guess, and brings us maybe to reflect on the question of what if we were looking at treaty making in a less masculinist way and in a more collaborative way, in a way where we don't have this kind of competition. But I think maybe more important, and I think you also have this idea in your materials already, is the question, if we have a treaty like that between two governments, or several governments actually, what is the effect of the treaty, or also of the end of the treaty, of the withdrawal from the treaty, on the entire population? And I think that's very important. And currently the situation is one of sanctions imposed by the US, which doesn't create the government response that is expected, but of course, on the other hand, it creates a lot of impact on the population. We know that if sanctions are imposed, the weakest parts of the population are the most affected. So we also know that women are over proportionally represented among the weakest parts of the population. You will remember the time when sanctions were imposed on Iraq in the 1990s and how many people and women in particular died as a result from those sanctions. I think this is pretty established. So I guess that's one thing that I think is very important from a feminist perspective, to always question what government action, what kind of effects that has on ordinary people and on women in particular. I think a similar thing can be said about the intermediate range nuclear force treaty that you also talk about, where again, I mean, at first sight you would say there doesn't seem to be any feminist concern at hand here, but again, this is about a question of how do Russia and the United States go forward in terms of their nuclearization policies. Certainly this is a move towards rearmament, not disarmament, that seems to be sort of in the background there. And then, of course, the question always is, how does this affect society as a whole, and women in particular? And I think also you talked about this in your materials. So that means a certain priority of nuclearization that takes money away from other areas where many, many people could potentially benefit from. It's also, again, from a feminist perspective, this focus on nuclear weapons shows us a certain concept of security, which is very partial, right? It seems to be a concept of security that was very strongly represented during the Cold War. And these days, we actually think much more, at least in scholarly circles, much more about rather than state security, we just think much more about human security and about societal security and so forth. But that seems to be sort of, you know, thrown by the wayside with this move. So again, I think we have to always think of the societal impacts of international treaties. When I started, I talked about human rights treaties and how those treaties actually aim at social transformation, and the interstate treaties don't. They seem to be, you know, about agreements between states. But it's also important for those treaties, I think, to always focus and showcase their societal impact. I think that's very important from a feminist perspective. And maybe just to come back to a few feminist strategies in working with these treaties or talking about these treaties. I think one thing, and actually you have historically also been part of this movement that has been really, really successful. If you look at what global women's movements or transnational actor networks that work for gender equality, what they have done over time, you know, if you think about the UN women's conferences, they have first actually tried to articulate a shared idea about how the world should look like from the perspective of women, what's a sort of a feminist or female-oriented worldview of justice. So that's something that happened across the World Women's Conferences. And once that was established, I mean, I'm not saying that there was total agreement, but the focus, I think, you know, with all the organizations that joined this kind of conversation, sort of the great, the grand parameters of that were sort of set was clear what the focus there was. After that, many of these organizations, they actually went into other subject areas that previously were not gendered at all, right? The environment, human rights, social policies, and so forth. They went to those conferences in the 1990s and pushed a gender perspective in to a degree that it actually couldn't be taken out anymore. And actually before it wasn't there, right? So I think this strategy of coming together as well-organized feminists and sort of come to an agreement on basic parameters, and then from there influence discourses and actors and people who are not so interested in gender issues. That has been a very, very successful strategy. And I think the form of action that you propose also goes into that direction. The other thing I think that's very important, and that also was one of the findings that we had in the edited volumes on feminist strategy, is one thing is for feminists to get a gendered perspective on the agenda, or sort of get people to listen to that. And that's oftentimes a huge success and very, very difficult. But then after that, actually, it's equally important to not only set the agenda, but also keep the agenda and stay at it and try to develop strategies that sort of keep people interested in this kind of idea and sort of, you know, be stubborn until change is achieved, so to say. So that was a very important finding that we had, that agenda setting is really good, but, you know, those topics go away, so you have to remain very stubborn. And then I think the last thing that I want to mention is that it's very important if you, as non-governmental civil society organizations, when you try to influence formal politics, like Congress, for example, or on the global level, the UN General Assembly and the Security Council and so forth, it's very important to have insider allies. So I guess to a certain degree, what I would like to say is, one thing is that it's very important to get all Congress people to listen to your messages in a way, because maybe otherwise they wouldn't hear that at all. But I think what's also equally important is to get insider allies that on your side, and not only the Congress people themselves, but also people in the government bureaucracies. So on the global level, we talked a lot about the Femocrats, for example, and that's actually a term that comes from Australia, and so that's also applicable to national and subnational politics. So Femocrats are people who work in state bureaucracies and have a feminist conviction, so to say. So to find those, identify those, and also other allies, not necessarily in the bureaucracies, but for example in academia and in other places, and to form those kind of coalitions, I think that's very important. I know that you are really good at that, so I can just say, I would say the strategies that you already employ, I would say they work. They don't necessarily, I guess, work very fast and easily and every time, but altogether, I think that's the way to go. I think that's what I have for you now, and I would be happy to have any questions.
Just to clarify, Professor, were you saying Femocrats, like feminist-ocrats, feminist-femocrats? Is that the word that you were using?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. Can you say it again?
You just described a category of people that it sounded like you were saying Femocrats, like feminist,
yes,
exactly. Ocrats. Okay.
Yes.
This is a new term for me. Maybe others on the call have heard it. But, it seems like what you're saying is makes it even more important for us WILF members to continue to make those calls to Congress that we mentioned earlier in the call.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important when we do that to identify ourselves as WILF members, because in doing so, they hear that they are not just hearing from an individual woman, but from a woman who is part of a feminist organization. Oh, that's really good. If folks have questions for the professor, please press number one on your phone keyboard and phone keypad, and we'll call on you. I think it's interesting to me that we have currently a candidate for president who seems to be running on this feminist platform and is getting no traction at all. This Marianne Williamson and also Tulsi Gabbard both have a very collaborative rather than competitive approach to the election, and also are talking about peace. And we just don't seem to be getting, they just don't seem to be getting much support. So did you have a comment to make about that, Professor?
So the first thought that I had is, I mean, of course, we also had Kirsten Gillibrand, who had a very particularly feminist platform, and she already dropped out, unfortunately. I think for the two candidates that you just mentioned, number one, I don't think that they are the only ones that would stand for this sort of, you know, multilateral international or foreign policy approach. And I'm thinking there's probably other reasons why their attraction is a little lower than that of others. Maybe, I mean, the gender issue is always there, of course, but then to a certain degree also lack of experience with Williamson not really being a politician and so forth. Right. But, yeah, it's, that's, I guess, my guess is as good as anybody's there.
Okay, again, if you have a question, press number one to... ask your question, and I see Darian has her hand up. Go ahead, Darian, your mic's open.
Thank you, and thank you, Mary Beth, for asking your good questions. I wondered if the Beijing Plus 25 anniversary that's coming up next year has led to any particular developments that our presenter can tell us more about.
Am I on?
Yes.
Yes.
I am. Okay. Not very much, I think, for several reasons. One is relatively fast after the Beijing conference, and the Beijing conference really represents a very high level of sort of feminist achievement, I think, on the international level. And, you know, the one part of the achievement is that it was a consensual document. So that's what was pretty amazing, I think. But very fast after that, there, you know, the resistance of more conservative forces to that became more powerful. Also, of course, we had September 11th, so that changed many dynamics in the multilateral setting. You know, there was much more hostility and much less trust in multilateralism. So already at that time, that was actually Beijing plus five around those times, the mode was really about defending Beijing rather than trying to move further and push further and reach better, even better achievements. And the fear really was if there were future women's conferences that this kind of consensus would actually be diluted and would become much weaker than what Beijing represented. And I think in a way that has remained, that kind of feeling that, you know, we needed to defend Beijing. And then one other strategy that I think was employed was to, rather than have a focus that is gender or women and girls specific, to integrate gender issues into general development agendas. And of course, we had the Millennium Development Goals, and now we have the Sustainable Development Goals, which I think are better, much better than the Millennium Development Goals, much more integrative of gender concerns. And you know, that's something where many people who focus on the global level, they rally around and try to make states work towards those goals. And I haven't heard all too much about making a big, reappearance of Beijing after 25 years. For those two reasons, lack of backlash, if you want, a lack of contestation, and threat of backlash and contestation, and on the other hand, that there are these other frameworks that people put their energies into.
Thank you for that answer, Professor. Did you have a follow up, Darian?
Thank you.
Okay. I see Nancy Price's hand is up. Go ahead and answer.
Yes. Well, thank you for this very interesting presentation, and certainly links with my project here in California in March. I wanted to ask you, because I've done a lot of work in what you could say are goal 6 and 7, drinking water and sanitation issues. And it seems to me that the issues around that focus on women are presented as separate sustainable development goals, as topics, separate topics of sustainable development goals. But when you think of the water issues, the question for me is, how will drinking water and sanitation, sewage and sanitation, be provided? Because those are hugely expensive infrastructures. And if that is through public-private partnerships or privatization, the impact on women and families and children and elderly and low-income populations is, as we've already seen, extremely serious. So I guess my question is, the way that the funding for realizing some of the sustainable development goals will have more or less impact on women, perhaps, and I haven't seen much discussion about that, and it rather worries me.
Yeah, okay, maybe two thoughts I have on that. Number one, I think you can be critical of the sustainable development goals, but I think one thing that they have is they have on the one hand the standalone goals for gender issues, and they try to integrate gender perspectives into the other goals. That has been, I think, really since Beijing, that's the strategy, to have a standalone and an integration and an intersectional integration also into other goals. I don't know exactly how this translates into the targets and so forth for the two goals that you just mentioned, but because I'm not super familiar with them at this point, but if I remember my reading of the Sustainable Development Goals, this is sort of the strategy from the gender advocacy perspective, which I think has been pretty successful there. And then the other thing with the funding, I absolutely share your concern. That's actually a general concern that I had with the process of the Sustainable Development Goals, that sort of the private actors became so prominent all of a sudden, the private for-profit actors became prominent, so that changes the strategies a lot, and oftentimes in a way that people are being left behind. I think that the problem with the Sustainable Development Goals there is that, as with many global documents, they are written in a way so that everybody somehow can feel they have a part and they own this. And in order to achieve this, oftentimes they are very broad and very vague and don't talk about the very specific steps that are needed to create strategies that are good for all. So, there's this principle, for example, that nobody should be left behind. That sounds very nice and sounds very inclusive, but it's left very open. And it's really, in a way, up to advocacy and activism,
right,
to articulate and fill those goals, I think. I mean, that's true for all global frameworks that we have. In themselves, they will not get you anywhere, I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
So, Professor, you were talking about the importance of maintaining a feminist strategy that's consistent and engaging between these flashpoints, between issues that come up. And, of course, maintaining that kind of engagement is difficult over the long haul for all kinds of efforts. But with all of the assaults on society coming from so many directions, it seems like the place that women could pull together is on this vision of a feminist piece, what it could look like, what the hopes for it would be, and that if we were able to continue to lift that up in a concerted way, not just, you know, when we're threatening to send troops or remove troops or whatever, it would make more sense. Are there countries now that are effectively launching that sort of long-term feminist engagement that doesn't just come up during the flashpoints?
So, I mean, these are always long-term developments, right? I mean, I don't want to be completely pessimistic about that. I mean, I think there are, sometimes, I don't know if you see those things, sometimes those surveys come out, you know, which country is the country, best country to be a woman or a mother in the world and so forth. And of course, you often have in Northern European countries always rank high. I think that is partly because of very long-term commitment of very, very many people to invest in social structures that allow that. I mean, and of course, as we know, no country is perfect, but there are differences, right? So I think that's one thing to invest in structures of redistribution, actually, and of recognition of women, but actually also anybody who is not making it in a world where you win if you use your elbows, so to say, right? How do you create structures of solidarity and so forth? But for example, I also think that the kind of activism that you see these days among feminists in many Latin American countries against many odds, right, against femicide in order to decriminalize abortion and so forth, that is a huge type of mobilization that I think will have lasting changes, even if maybe the particular law that you want changed this year, that's not successful, but in general, that will make a difference. So I think if you look closely and if you look in particular sectors, you can find many of those things around the world. I know right now it doesn't look so bright, but I think there has been, and for many decades actually, a lot of work by many women in many parts of the world. So I don't want to be very pessimistic about that.
Okay. All right, well, I don't see any other hands up, and I don't want to monopolize you by asking the only question. So for now, I think I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. It's been a really wonderful adjunct to our October solidarity action to have you here.
Great, I'm glad. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor for me.
Yes, thank you so much, Professor Zwingo. You've given us a lot to think about as we prepare for our October Solidarity Actions. We so appreciate your work to address patriarchy as an obstacle for effective peacemaking. And thanks also to our members for their good questions.